couple of them are starting to come back organically. We have a wood mill here. We need to do value-added wood. There's a lot of things we can do here, but, you know, the state has just simply not been supportive of looking at any kind of alternative green visions. So my mayorship and Richwood is a bit of an anomaly in the system in that my election is almost a curiosity because the state is becoming redder and redder and redder.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we will certainly follow your mayoralty. Bob Henry Baber, mayor-elect of Richwood, West Virginia. West Virginia, which is experiencing a once-in-a-thousand-year flood. Ken Pimlott, director of California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, thanks for joining us, and Professor Michael Mann. That does it for our broadcast. We have job openings. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to
Community Radio, the is a proud co-sponsor of the film premiere screening of Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson. Sunday, July 3rd at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Vietnam veteran S. Brian Wilson was run over and nearly killed by a military train during a nonviolent protest in 1987. Paying the Price for Peace tells the story of Wilson's activism and exposes the truth about the United States' addiction to war and the lies it perpetuates in order to wage ongoing violence. S. Brian Wilson and the film's producer will be in attendance. Again, that's KBOO Community Radio's premiere screening of Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson, Sunday, July 3rd at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Yay! This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. Please, no home recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on KBOO Evening News, hearings for the oil train terminal have begun in Vancouver.
A live in-studio, we will talk to Willie Levinson about The Big Float.
We'll also talk to Judith Arcana about feminism 100 years ago.
When they're done, when they say I'm blah, 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 and I'm blah, 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 you're going to be done. Bring down the music.
Get rid of the instant replay. That's not the right button.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 28th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. On Monday, hundreds gathered outside of a hearing in Vancouver, Washington, for the proposed building of the largest marine oil train terminal in the United States. This happening just 1 month after the oil train explosion in Mosier, Washington. Inside, there were more than a dozen speaking against the construction and only two advocates speaking on behalf of the terminal. Air Cascadia's Chris Andre interviewed Brett Vandenhoevel from Columbia River Keeper and gave us an idea on what's on the table with this proposed terminal.
There's 18 different groups or parties, many, conservation groups, but also The city of Vancouver is opposing this. Multiple cities, the city of Spokane, Clark County has weighed in, saying that their jail is in dangerous proximity to the oil terminal, and they think it's unacceptable, the proposed oil terminal. So it's a chance for everyone to make their arguments in front of this board that will make a recommendation to Governor Inslee, who will make the ultimate decision. So it's a little more detail. You know, there's experts involved, and instead of the typical 2 or 3 minutes the public gets to talk about this. So, I mean, we're excited to make the case. We think that this is an absolute wrong move for Vancouver and for the Pacific Northwest. And, I mean, essentially, people who are familiar with the Keystone XL pipeline, you know, they're proposing nearly half the capacity of Keystone to be brought in to basically through downtown Vancouver on these explosive oil trains. I mean, it's an absolutely insane proposal, and you know, we think that the Energy Council will hear that from many, many different people, and that Tesoro and the oil companies, you know, arguments that are safe, it's just, you know, they're just not going to be able to say that in a very compelling way after this oil train explosion, not to mention all the other explosions over the last several years and the oil industry's poor safety record. And like you mentioned, Chris, the rail industry's has a, you know, a notorious record as well. The 3 years ago in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, 47 people died when an oil train exploded and incinerated part of their downtown. You know, what happened there was the rail line quickly went bankrupt, and you know, some of the oil companies tried to pool some money to fund some of this, but the bottom line is that one of these worst case but very possible scenarios is uninsurable. You know, there's been articles of experts talking about there is not enough insurance available in the free market to cover something like this. It's just impossible.
That's so, more realistic.
That was Brett VandenHeuvel speaking with Chris André from Air Cascadia.
And on the same subject, this continuing battle against fossil fuel export terminals on the West Coast has seen a victory in Oakland, California, even as hearings against oil train terminals have begun here in Vancouver.
On a unanimous vote, the Oakland City Council passed a ban on the storage and handling of coal and petroleum coke in the city. The ban is expected to derail plans for a massive export terminal on the city-owned waterfront, known as the Oakland Bulk and Oversized Terminal. Port developers have been working on a partnership with four Utah counties to export up to 10 million tons of coal out of Oakland each year. This would have made Oakland the largest coal export facility on the West Coast and would increase U.S. coal exports by 19%. Much closer to Portland, 5 weeks of hearings began yesterday in Vancouver concerning the Tesoro Savage Vancouver Energy Terminal, which would be the nation's largest oil-by-rail terminal. The terminal would handle about 360,000 barrels of crude oil from a daily average of 4.5-mile-long crude oil trains coming through the Columbia River Gorge. Washington State's Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council is holding the hearings and will make a recommendation to Governor Jay Inslee, who has the final say. Governor Inslee and Oregon Governor Kate Brown have called for a temporary moratorium on oil by rail through their states in the wake of the June 3rd derailment in Mosier, Oregon. Only two groups will argue in support of the project during the 5 weeks of hearings, while more than a dozen entities are opposed. Last weekend, 21 activists were arrested in Vancouver after forming a human blockade along the tracks. For KBOO News, I'm Laura DeLego.
City inspectors recently discovered large chunks of glass in the sewer near Bullseye Glass in southeast Portland. Portland fined Bullseye $300 for the dumped glass and is requiring them to clean the nearby sewers as well as install pollution controls. Reports show that the state was aware of the dumping concerns well before sending city inspectors to the company. A test on a nearby stormwater catch found levels of selenium over 200 micrograms above the allowed level due to the glass. Test results will be back in mid-July on underground wells on the property to assess the effects on groundwater. In addition to polluting the water, Bullseye Glass was found this spring to be releasing toxic chemicals into the air.
The state of Oregon has been given $4.9 million from the U.S. Department of Education in order to help improve education in schools with the lowest performance scores statewide. The money will be spread across 9 different schools, but will be based on school performance reports that are 4 to 5 years old. These performance reports are outdated, and they'll fail to reflect the rapidly changing demographics of the Portland metro area, as well as the rest of the state. Although Timothy Boyd, the director of district and school effectiveness, has asked the federal agency to use up-to-date reports, his request was ultimately denied. The money will be divided over 5 years in hopes of turning around these low-performing schools. However, there are worries of what will happen once the funding runs dry. Even if progress is made in these schools, it's unclear how these schools will sustain themselves in the long run.
The last votes were coming in today for a special election in Harney County to recall Judge Steve Grasty, the top administrator of the sparsely populated county. Supporters of the recall say Grasty violated free speech rights and rights to freedom of assembly when he refused to allow the Bundy militants to use a county building to hold a meeting. The Bundy group had made the request during their armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. The headquarters of the refuge, located 30 miles south of Burns, is still closed, though refuge roads are open. The vote underscores divisions that remain in the county more than 4 months after the 41-day occupation that ended on February 11th. At more than 10,000 square miles, Harney County is Oregon's largest, with only 7,100 residents. It is also one of the least populated.
The Portland Bureau of Transportation, known as the PBOT, and the Private for Hire Transportation Advisory are seeking input from those with disabilities in order to improve taxis and private services, such as Uber and Lyft, in the city of Portland. Although the city requires such taxi services to serve everyone, PBOT says that there is limited information on transportation demands for those with disabilities. PBOT hopes that the information they gather from the survey will help to make these services more accessible to everyone. The survey will only be available for 3 weeks. In order to take this survey, go online and visit www.portlandoregon.gov/transportation/PDX rides.
The Burgerville employees have been getting community support for their ongoing strike. While workers have been asking for a raise in wages, one store was given floor mats as a response to their request. A recent claim of victory for the strikers is an employee named Ivy who got her job back after a long back along with pay back pay after claiming retaliation by her store manager. Employees for the union continue to plan on organizing in the community to keep fighting for their wage demands. KBOO recently attended the Burgerville Workers Union Solidarity Ride during Petalpalooza. Workers had this to say.
Tomorrow, on Monday, we have a super exciting and frustrating moment where Claire, I'm gonna raise your hand. Claire is going to be sitting down with Jeff Harvey, the CEO of Burgerville. Now, that sounds awesome because that's what we want to do. We want to sit down and negotiate. We are the union. We want to talk about how we can make our jobs better. Unfortunately, when Jeff Harvey offered us to sit down and talk to him, it was under the condition that we not talk about the union.
That was live audio from the Burgerville Workers Union Solidarity Ride during Petalpalooza.
This week, the city of Portland commemorates a remarkable and complicated historic event. 100 years ago, Portland officials threw Margaret Sanger and Dr. Marie Equi into jail for the crime of distributing birth control pamphlets. Locally, activists and artists will be recreating the feminists' activities with the Birth Control Brigade Street Theater. And here with us to talk about it is Judith Arcana. Thanks for coming in, Judith.
Thank you.
And first of all, tell us the story of what happened with Sanger and Equi in 1916.
1916, June 29th, 100 years ago tomorrow, they were on
Sanger was on a national tour. Equi was her pal and in some sense her mentor in those years. And they were preparing for a speaking engagement. It was a two-pronged thing. It'd take too long for us to do right now. But what happened on that date was they were having this event. It was at the Baker Theater, which is roughly where Pioneer Square is, close to that anyway, was there. And as soon as the action began, the cops arrived, grabbed both Dr. Equi and Nurse Sanger and two more women who were with them, Portlanders, and hauled them off to the courthouse where they were. Obviously, they had been arrested. They also were tried and jailed. It was a quick process. What's really striking, though, is that some hundreds of people followed, yelling, "Arrest us, too! Arrest us, too!" Because, of course, they, too, were doing the quote-unquote obscene and lewd thing, using birth control and talking about it, which was the crime.
That was a crime back
then.
That
was the crime,
wow.
Yes.
And who were the allies that Sanger and Equi had?
There were many. It's interesting because this was the only place where it got really ugly like that, and yet this was also a place where there was a birth control league. There were at least 70 members in 1916. There were also other doctors and medical personnel who were in favor. Dr. Equi herself had certainly been giving out birth control information. She was a great supporter of and essentially a deliberate professional servant to the working classes. She worked with union folks, and she had been doing abortions and teaching birth control among them long before this. And so there was a network, so to speak, of allies.
Actually performing abortions. And what can you tell us about the story of the Janes?
Actually, a cue line. The Janes, as we are called, I'm a Jane, created an underground abortion service in the city of Chicago in the late 60s and early 70s. This was pre-Roe, so that everything we did was underground and illegal. We really were breaking a law, whereas the law that Equi and Sanger were breaking had just been cooked up by the city council, like, you know, metaphorically speaking, minutes before the arrest. But in our case, it was truly an underground, deliberately political slash criminal experience. And like all such things, everything that's illegal, the police always know who's doing what. It's an open secret. Whether you're doing truly bad stuff, like hustling dangerous drugs that are not as healthy as some might be, or providing health care for women and girls in need. Police even sent people to us, the medical school people. When I called a friend once and said, listen, if somebody needs an abortion, he was a student, where should she go? And he called me back about 6 hours later and said, everybody here, and here was the University of Illinois Medical School in Chicago, everybody here says, call this number and ask for Jane. That was even before I was a Jane. Anyway, that's a very short, fast answer to your question.
Yeah, your questions or your answers are going to have to all be quick because it's such a huge subject involving potentially half of everybody.
There are books and there are movies. Check it out, folks.
Yeah. So tell us your take on the recent Supreme Court decision about Texas's limits on abortion rights.
A time of good news. Good news is scarce these days, but that was truly good news. As probably most of the folks listening to you all here know, on Monday, yesterday, the Supreme Court announced its decision in the Texas case. The decision essentially makes it possible for abortion health care to still be provided, not as much as it should be, but certainly not as little as it would have been if the governor and his minions had had their way with the law that the court struck down, which made it very, 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 very difficult for clinics to be open and function appropriately.
And you are going to have a street theater on this subject. What made you come up with that as an idea?
Well, you know, like everything else, it started with a little germ of a notion. Oh, let's celebrate that anniversary. Let's talk about the relationship between what happened in 1916 and what's happening now in 2016 and how it's not necessarily all better all the time, but still, you know, something to celebrate, people taking to the streets and demanding their rights for health care and reproductive justice. And we thought maybe a couple of us would walk around, hand out leaflets. And now there's this little team of us, five of us, the birth control brigade. And we're going to follow this little route that I mentioned earlier, starting at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning at the Oregon Historical Society on that little outdoor plaza right near the park blocks. So y'all should come join us, listen to a few words of our talking at you and answering questions as we walk. And we'll go to a few other places and wind up at the courthouse, just like they did 100 years ago.
The courthouse. And tell us a little bit about your own career as an artist and how you've been impacted by the work of these people who were there before you, even though it was illegal.
Well, I'm a writer. I write poems and stories and essays and books. And it is quite true. The way you just put it is accurate. I certainly have felt the impact of the women who came before me and some men as well, good folks, who did righteous work. And I've written both about them and out of my own life experience and stuff I, as you do when you're a writer, made up, rooted in the facts of that past.
And is it possible to give us a little verbal preview of what will actually be happening with this street theater so we can kind of envision it?
One of the things that we'll do is as we walk along our route and when we stop at the various places we've chosen to pause and carry on, is repeat some of the slogans. We'll have signs. We'll have stuff to hand out with the signs. Stuff like what I said before, arrest us too, and poor women need access to what rich women have always had, and so on and so on and so on. Some of us will be wearing what are called period costumes. I myself will be wearing garments of the 1916 variety, and several other people will be dressed unusually in that way also. Other people will just look like ordinary 2016 types.
And is it possible for our listeners to actually be there and participate in any way?
I certainly hope so. Yes, indeed.
As the Arrest Us Too group?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Good attitude. We start at 11 at the Oregon Historical Society. Then probably by 11:35 or so, we'll be over in the area of the Wednesday morning farmers market, you know, in Shemansky Park in the South Park block.
Shemansky, yeah.
Yep. And then we'll go to that area near what I call the Piazza, Pioneer Square, where the hotel used to be 100 years ago. So that's another place. And you can join us anywhere along the way, even at, let's say, 12:30 or so at the courthouse.
All right. You expect to be about 12:30 at the courthouse. Very good. Well, thanks for coming in, Judith.
Thank you very much.
That was Judith Arcana. Find out details about the Birth Control Brigade on their Facebook page. That page is called BC, like Birth Control, Brigade Street Theater. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news in depth at 5:45. That will be followed by This Way Out at 6. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of about 84 degrees, a low of about 55, or in other words, perfect. East of the Cascades in Hood River, it'll be sunny also with a high of 86, a low of about 60. Today in history, back in 1871, the yen became the new currency in the nation of Japan. And the quote for today comes from Ralph Waldo Emerson himself, who said, "Money often costs too much."
It's almost time for that special event built around celebrating the Willamette River in which people are encouraged to jump in. It's the 6th annual Big Float coming up July 10th. Here to talk about it is Willie Levinson of the Human Access Project. Thanks for being here tonight, Willie.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Why did you start this event?
I started the event because I had just lived in two communities that had a really strong relationship with the rivers. These communities really embraced the river. It was a pride of the community. You'd get off work in the summertime. What would you do? You'd get in the river. You would swim in the river. You'd float in the river. You'd fish in the river. And as a result, these communities really took care of the river. When I moved to Portland 20 years ago from Boise, Idaho, I just assumed, because of Portland's green reputation, that people would love their river too. But what I came to understand is I got indoctrinated, like a lot of people do when you first move to Portland, that it rains a lot here and never put your toe in the Willamette because it'll kill you. So initially, I was really disappointed and river. So I wanted to have a way to affect change. And my thought was, after the completion of the big pipe project, it used to be that after a tenth of an inch of rain, raw sewage would flow into the Willamette River. So there's a very good reason why a lot of people would think the Willamette River was disgusting. But the big pipe project was a success. It cost $1.44 billion to complete. Instead of having combined sewer overflow after a tenth of an inch of rain, where it would happen 50 to 100 times every year, now it only happens four times a year. And I don't apologize for a combined sewer overflow. It is disgusting, and I feel collective shame for our community when it happens. But that's a significant improvement, and it's going to be very unusual for there to be a sewage overflow in the summertime ever again. So armed with that information, I thought, hey, well, I mean, people are very emotional creatures. Humans are emotional creatures. If we were all logical, you could just hand somebody a piece of paper that said scientifically it's safe for swimming now. The Willamette River has been restored to the point that we can swim now. But people are emotional. So I thought, hey, you know, we have a big event where we showcase lots of people in the river actually not dying and having fun and splashing around. That speaks volumes. And we're in our sixth year now. We're anticipating 3,000 to 4,000 people floating in downtown Portland. And it's a great way to celebrate the Willamette. And it's also a fundraiser for our organization, Human Access Project.
Great. And how's this event changed over the years?
Well, you know, every year we try to make it a little bit safer. That's for sure. And every year we try to add a fun little new spice to it. So, for example, the first couple of years, we actually paraded across the Hawthorne Bridge. And that was always fun because we literally had the entire stretch of the Hawthorne Bridge, a parade of people holding inner tubes, which is really dramatic. And then we would float back across. But after the second year we did that, I had a debriefing meeting with the Coast Guard, just asking, is there anything we can do to make this event safer? And I said, you know, we're really not comfortable with you guys floating across the Willamette because it's a navigational channel. Technically, we can't close it. So I said, well, how about we just float across one more year? And their answer was, well, you said that last year, Willie. So I said, okay, I forget that, but okay, let's adapt a little bit. So the adaptation was just staying on the west side. We now put in at an area we've nicknamed Poets Beach. It's an area a few years back, Human Access Project got permission from Parks Department, Army Corps of Engineers, and Department of State Lands to simply cut into some riprap rock that's lining the path and to create a safe trail to this really nice beach that's under the Markham Bridge. We then flowed back. Last year, we added 2 75-foot slip and slides at the Tomahawk Bowl, which was super fun. This year, we are adding dragon boat people-powered inner tube taxis. So dragon boats have 20 people rowing, and sometimes people get tired in the big float. So this year, if you get tired, you can just grab a hold of one of the dragon boat inner tube taxis, and they're going to tow people around. So that'll be fun.
Great. And who else works with you in creating this event, and who comes out to the river when it does happen, when it happens?
It is such a awesome team of volunteers that we have for Human Access Project. We have, you know, pro bono attorneys, practically pro bono graphic designers. We have people who help us with copying and sending out newsletters. It's just an amazing team of people that we really are pretty selective of who we bring in. to our team, but they all share three qualities. They're all cool, capable, and committed. And with that, you get people who are committed, who like to have fun, and are capable, and you can make magic things happen, like the big float. So, who comes out to the river when it happens? You know, this is an event that I think everybody can identify with. I mean, I suppose it's one of those things. Everybody, I suppose, isn't drawn to water, but I do think it's kind of an innate thing in people. Water is really powerful. Even if you don't get into it, it's really therapeutic to look at it. And I think the people who come to this event, I mean, in a lot of ways, my activism, the activism of Human Access Project, I kind of think of the big float as tricking kids to eat their vegetables. I mean, I do think there's a lot of people who individually might feel intimidated about going to the Willamette River, but once they get in, their relationship with the Willamette River is transformed. So we like to just try to set up a really fun environment for people to maybe check out the Willamette River for the first time. And ultimately, you know, we're making a difference. I mean, tomorrow, the city of Portland is holding a open house at the PCC Climb Center on Water Avenue from 4 to 6. They're going to be discussing putting beaches in downtown Portland. So, you know, we like to think that we influence that process. In fact, we put a proposal into Mayor Hales last year, which was the result of that, the studies that have come from that. So that's really satisfying. So, you know, we kind of started off as the big float. Our not-for-profit emerged from that. And I like to think of the big float as the world's laziest revolution. You can make a difference simply by putting your butt on an inner tube and letting the city know you want greater access to a river that's owned by the citizens of Oregon. It's Portland's largest public open space. And presently, by Portland Parks and Recreation estimates, only 5% of it's accessible. So unless you own a house on the river or a boat, this space is largely cut off from you. So it really is an equity issue as much as anything else.
And can you give us a rundown on where people can get into the Willamette most safely?
Most safely right now, I'd say, you know, the Holman Dock south of the Hawthorne Bridge is really popular. If you go to our website, humanaccessproject.com, we have some recommended swimming areas. But I'd like to say, too, I know we're running out of time. The Superfund process is open right now. The lead advocates for that, Willamette Riverkeeper and Audubon, and Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group have done an awesome job to get an extension on the comment period. But it's really important to have your voice heard. Human Access Project is right in step with Audubon and Riverkeeper. We want to have a really strong cleanup, and we want to see a cleanup where fish advisories could be lifted. So get out, and we recommend going to Audubon Society or Riverkeeper for more information on commenting.
Great, and thank you. Thanks, Willie. That is Willie Levinson of the Human Access Project. Find all the information about Big Float 6 online at www.humanaccessproject.com.
Or thebigfloat.com.
Or thebigfloat.com. Find out more about how to testify about the Superfund issue on Portland Audubon Society's website, www.audubonportland.org, and follow the links on the homepage to take action.
Thanks, everybody.
Oh, thank you. Pennsylvania has passed a bill to not regulate and update their oil and gas operation, which in turn eliminates environmental protection. SB 279, called the Pengrade Crude Development Advisory Council Bill, wipes out updated environmental protection requirements for conventional oil and gas operations. In between 2008 and 2014, conventional operators were responsible for 60% of the cases in which oil and gas activities contaminated the private water supplies of Pennsylvanians. Eight Pennsylvanian counties have a raised cancer risk due to toxic emissions in the air. Another part of SB 279 requires the use of public funds to run an advisory council made up primarily of oil and gas industry representatives. So not only does the bill eliminate environmental protections from oil and gas operations, it holds any future attempt to improve them hostage to oil and gas industry interest.
Hate attacks have grown in number and frequency in the United Kingdom after voters narrowly chose to leave the European Union. The Muslim Council of Britain has reported over 100 hate attacks in the first few days since the vote. A charity in the province of Wales reports receiving over 60 reports of hate crimes and incidents in their region alone. Attacks have focused on Muslims, on immigrants, on people of color, and on refugees. Xenophobic placards and graffiti referring to Polish immigrant workers as dirty or as vermin were documented among dozens of attacks across the nation of England. Taunts of, quote, "We voted, now get out," were hurled at Muslims who were reported by the dozens. A group that tracks and documents attacks on Muslims issued a statement recommending vigilance as xenophobic nationalist groups from other European countries are seeking to develop alliances with xenophobes in the United Kingdom.
An explosion went off in Istanbul's Atatürk airport today, killing 28 people and injuring 60 more, with the count expected to climb. Officials say attackers detonated one explosive just outside of the terminal and two explosives at the entrance of the international terminal, killing themselves in the blast as well. The airport was evacuated by police soon after. This is the latest in a recent string of attacks in Turkey. The government has blamed past attacks on ISIS and Kurdish separatists. It is unclear at this time who is responsible for today's attack. These attacks have had a large impact on Turkey's tourism industry, which makes up a significant portion of Turkey's overall economy. Planes are set to stop landing after 9:10 p.m. GMT, with flights to Atatürk Airport already prevented from taking off.
And now it's time for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. My apologies if you've missed my commentaries the last 2 weeks. I've been having terrible computer problems on the road, and that made it impossible to meet my weekly deadlines. I've got it all fixed now. Sorry about that. Here's a recent story about oil companies and corporate constitutional so-called rights that you may have missed, as it wasn't widely reported. Although you may have heard the first part of the story, which is that the directors of the big oil companies continue to resist the increasingly vocal call for a full transition to renewable energy and away from fossil fuels. But have you ever asked yourself why corporate directors are allowed to ignore the rising chorus of voices demanding that the oil companies radically change course? The answer, believe it or not, is corporate constitutional rights. All of the oil companies exercise these rights in a myriad of ways. For example, their boards of directors have the authority to make key societal decisions about energy policy because the corporate decision-making process itself is considered an intangible property right of a corporate person. Yes, that's right. Not even the President of the United States, not even the governors or legislatures, not even the Attorney General has the authority to stop the oil company boards of directors from continuing to drill baby drill. Corporate boards of directors have the legal authority to make whatever decisions they wish to make, even those that will guarantee catastrophic climate destabilization, simply because the corporation is allowed to exercise its intangible property rights as a corporate person, thanks to the Supreme Court. A few months ago, attorneys general from a number of states came together to subpoena internal documents from Exxon Corporation to investigate whether Exxon's directors misled the public on climate science over the past few decades. Specifically, they accused Exxon of defrauding the government and consumers and misrepresenting its knowledge of the likelihood that its products and activities have contributed and are contributing to climate change. In response, Exxon's directors filed their own lawsuit to block the subpoena, claiming that the order violates the company's constitutional rights. Quote, "Defendants' actions violate Exxon's constitutionally protected rights of freedom of speech, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, and due process of law," unquote. Exxon's complaint further states that the Attorney General's inquiry will have a chilling effect on Exxon's ability to engage in the climate change debate and discriminates based on viewpoint to target one side of an ongoing policy debate. They even ran a full-page ad in the New York Times on May 18 with the headline, "Abuse of Power,
all Americans have the right to support causes they believe in. The ad goes on to say, quote, "The right to speak out is among the most fundamental principles of American democracy. It should never be taken away. Yet around the country, a group of state attorneys general have launched a misguided effort to silence the views and voices of those who disagree with them," unquote. Let's unpack this outrageous series of claims from Exxon's lawyers. First, in a truly democratic society, a corporation would have no constitutionally protected rights whatsoever. It would have only the privileges granted to it in its operating charter, also known as its Articles of Incorporation, which was actually the law of the land till the late 1800s. Let's not forget, a corporation is merely a business structure. You can't take a photograph of a corporation because it doesn't exist in the material world. It's a mind-made concept like the number six. If I set up a debate between you and the number six, you'd think I was nuts, right? But that's exactly what's being argued here. A corporation doesn't have views, doesn't have a voice, doesn't even have a mouth. And the idea that government officials should not be allowed to investigate a business corporation's activities because that would violate the corporation's freedom of speech, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, and due process of law, this is a truly mind-blowing legal argument. And it's terrifying to imagine the courts granting this new right. And yet, if history is any guide, the Supreme Court will grant this new constitutional right to Exxon Corporation sometime in the next few years. And then government investigations and subpoenas of corporate documents will be a thing of the past. Can we afford to head down this path? I say no, and it's a high time that we the people put an end to this silliness. Want to learn more about how climate change activists can become more effective in challenging the oil companies so that this sort of thing is never allowed to happen? Check out the nationally broadcast speech I gave in Minneapolis last year titled, "We the People Standing Together to Protect Our Climate, Lessons from the Community Rights Movement." You can find it on my website at paulcienfuegos.com. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Grace Ann Smith, Abigail Sloan, Chimani Ward-Lewis, and Laura Del Lago. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Ed Lichtenstein, our director. Our engineer is Wesley Seiwei. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncard. Coming up tomorrow morning, Wednesday, on KBOO at 7 a.m., it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland will speak with scientist Paul Beckwith about climate change. Too late or not too late? Is that the question? At 9:30 on Political Perspectives, we'll feature our annual broadcast of the 1989 radio documentary entitled Remembering Stonewall. At 10, it'll be Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 a.m. on the Radio Zine, SW Concert will speak with documentary producer and investigative journalist Bill Curtis about the role of broadcast media in education. The exposés of government surveillance by Edward Snowden and by WikiLeaks, and he'll also talk about the challenges and opportunities for investigative reporting in this digital age wherein we all find ourselves. Thanks to you, KBOO members, for your generous support of our station here. And if you're not a current member, you can become one easily by simply going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Davey D of Hard Knock Radio talks with former Black Panther Doruba Bin Wahad about the history of gun control and how it pertains to the Black community.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And right now on everybody's mind is the question of gun control. The reason being, we saw the massacre that took place last week or the week before last in Orlando, Florida, where 49 or 50 Black and brown, mostly LGBT people, were killed by a lone gunman. We later come to find out that part of the carnage was also with the police who stormed the place, but that we'll get into that on another day. But what this massacre really invoked was the big debate around gun control and what does that mean. And this is something that has been heavily pushed by the Democratic Party. As we speak today, there's a hashtag called Disarm Hate. And it's really in response to the fact that the Republicans have once again resisted any attempts of gun control. I wanted to talk to former Black Panther Doruba Bin Wahad to get an idea, and I know you've been working on a piece that deals with the history of gun control, and especially as it pertains to Black people. Before we start, I'm just going to give my personal opinion on this. When we talk about gun control, I'm for gun control if everybody is putting their guns down.